So, what's your bowling average?
I'd rather not talk about that subject.
Harry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is March 30th, 1992. And I'm continuing my interview with Orrin Hellstead, former dean of the law school. I believe we left it off last time. We were talking about student placement after graduation from law school. What areas of law practice did students during your time period typically enter, your period as dean?
I would say that during my deanship, about 45% went into private practice right out of law school. Of those, perhaps 70% went into practice in Wisconsin and about 30% outside of Wisconsin. The remainder divided among a variety of occupations, some of which certainly can be considered to be law practice, but with some public agencies such as district attorney's offices. We had a fair number who would take positions with the district attorney's offices out of law school. A number of others go into practice with the other public service agencies, public defender's offices, for example, and a number going to go to work for business entities, for corporations, and some others will take judicial clerkships, fairly good-sized number, I would guess 5 to 10% of the class. These are considered to be fairly prestigious positions, some with the Supreme Court, some with the Circuit Courts of Appeals. Real prestige job is considered to be a clerkship with some Justice of the United States Supreme Court. I don't know that we have placed anyone there in recent years, but occasionally we do. Law training is a rather broad type of education that can be helpful in a variety of occupations, and up to this time, law schools have not tried to make specialists out of their graduates. It's conceivable that that time may come because the bar itself is considering licensing of specialists at the present time. But so far, there has been very little of that.
Yeah, I guess with medicine and everything, I can see how that would happen. Yeah. All those areas are becoming so terribly specialized. Moving on to curriculum during your deanship. You mentioned early in your deanship in an article in Gargoyle that the trend in legal education was more and more, and here I'm quoting, away from the heavy reliance on the case method of instruction and toward more emphasis on the teaching of practice skills through simulation and clinical practices. Could you talk a little bit about this trend and how it went through, how it struck throughout your deanship?
The trend actually started back around 1968. I think I've already talked a little bit about the Council on Legal Education for Professional Responsibility, which provided initial funding to get clinical programs started. And most law schools, I believe, have continued them, as is true at Wisconsin. We had a major study of the clinical programs in the mid-70s, which resulted in some tightening of the rules around 1976 or thereabout. And a few of our programs were eliminated at that time. Those that we referred to as farm-out programs with very little faculty supervision. And the programs that remained had to meet certain quality standards, mainly that there would be relatively close faculty supervision and that faculty members would receive teaching credit for their involvement in the clinical programs. So that, in a sense, there was perhaps a little bit of a reduction in the number of programs, although I think perhaps not in terms of the number of students who have participated in the programs, because the programs that remained actually grew a little bit, I think, in terms of student enrollments. I think I estimated at one point that roughly 100 students per semester took part in clinical programs. In addition, we have a fair number of simulation programs which do not involve contact with clients as such, but which simulate legal practice. The general practice course is one of them, and we typically have enrolled about 70 students on the average each semester in that program. That program was cut back a little bit as a result of the self-study that took place during the latter part, during the early part of the 80s, I guess. And it was agreed at that time that there would be some resource reallocation, and primarily it involved cutting out one section of general practice and setting sort of a base budget for the other clinical programs with the idea that the budget would not increase at a greater rate than inflation. Again, this relates, I think, to what I believe I mentioned, sort of a tension between the practice-oriented group in the faculty and the more academically oriented. Never are quite enough resources to go around, mm-hmm. So there is always this question as to what the priorities should be. But on the whole, the law school during my deanship and since then has continued to support clinical education at a fairly substantial level. I started to mention the simulation programs, which technically are not clinical programs. In addition to the general practice course, there are a number of trial advocacy courses that students take each semester, usually taught by practicing attorneys whom we bring in to do the teaching, although there are a couple of members of the regular faculty who also teach in that area.
Are there any particular programs that were, I'm talking now about the clinical practices programs that were started during your law during your deanship, or that developed significantly during your deanship that you can recall offhand?
I believe all the clinical programs that currently are running were started before my deanship. I think all of them were started around 1968 to 1970.
Speaking just personally now, did you welcome this type of movement in the law curriculum?
I did. I suppose if I had to classify myself, I would tend to fall more toward the professional or practice-oriented end of the spectrum as compared with the academic. But I thought that it was important to have both, and that the problem was to maintain a proper balance between the two.
Is that a problem that you experienced in dealing with the faculty? Were there really strong emotions on either side of that? Or?
I think it's fair to say that there were strong emotions, and I believe they were particularly evident during the formative stages, which was mainly during Spencer Kimball's and George Bond's administration, because by the time I became dean, the programs were pretty much in place. But this tension with regard to allocation of resources shows up quite regularly, I think, and particularly shows up at the time of hiring a faculty, when the question is what kind of faculty members to hire. And often what resulted is that there was some sort of a compromise. At least this is my view, that we would hire maybe one or two who were very academically oriented. If we hired someone who was more practice-oriented. Now, they all, of course, had to meet certain standards, but I think it's fair to say that that tension was present and was exacerbated, I think, to some extent by the fact that the Social Sciences Divisional Committee was seemingly putting more and more pressure on toward the academically oriented because of the emphasis on research that promoted new knowledge and so on. And there actually was some discussion in the faculty in the late 70s as to whether we ought to try to secede from this social sciences division and espouse some sort of a professional schools division or something like that. But nothing came of it. And I think we did manage to elect a member from the law faculty to the Social Sciences Divisional Committee, and that helped the situation somewhat. The law faculty member was able to do a little better job of setting forth the perspectives of a professional school to the other members of that committee.
Now, that's something we hadn't talked about. Let's just turn to the Social Science Divisional Committee for just one second. Were there any other issues in which the you thought, or the law school thought, that the Social Science Divisional Committee was more or less trying to dictate to the law school, or force the law school, or coerce the law school into going in directions that it wasn't particularly interested in?
No, I think it was mainly the heavy emphasis on research and research productivity, and I think that one of the problems that law faculty members have is that they are not the product of a PhD program, generally speaking. There may be exceptions, but generally we do not require a faculty member to have a PhD, which usually means that the faculty member has not gone through a rigorous research type of program before that person becomes a faculty member, and so sort of has to start from scratch. And I think that puts the law school at a disadvantage in these situations.
You mentioned that there was this kind of a yin and a yang going on in the department between the research people and the more clinical people. Is it fair to say that it was sort of a standoff between the two, that neither side really ever gained a total upper hand in terms of that?
I think that's right. I felt fairly comfortable with the balance that we had. I felt it was important that we had a number of members of the faculty who were strong in the research area, since we are a department of a major research university. On the other hand, I felt it also was important that we have some faculty members with a practice orientation in view of the fact that we try to prepare people to enter into the practice of law when they get out of law school. And I think it is fair to say that we've maintained a reasonable balance.
We had talked earlier in the last session about major curricular changes that took place during your years as a professor in the law school. Are there any others that you can recall, that any other major curriculum changes that took place within the law school during your years as dean?
I don't think there were any major curricular changes. Faculty went into the matter rather thoroughly in this self-study that took place around 1980, I guess it was. There were a few recommendations that came out of that study, but none of them major ones. From time to time, the faculty will take a look at the second and third year curriculum and realize that it's kind of a mishmash, and they will express some urge to do something about it, but usually nothing ever happens. And I would say that one of the reasons for this is that the law school operates under a budget situation where a certain number of faculty members have to be on leave in any given semester or academic or fiscal year in order to have enough money to go around. And this has some advantages, and maybe I've commented on this before, but in the sense that faculty members like it very much because they're able to go on leave on very short notice whenever they get money for a research project or some other leave. And at the same time, then it frees up some money that the law school can use for hiring lecturers to fill in the gaps in the curriculum and so on. But it makes curricular planning or a structured curriculum very difficult to achieve. And and as long as our salary structure was such that had difficulty competing with major schools, I guess I personally felt that we had to treat our faculty members as nice as possible. And this was one way to do it. And so I never made any big push to try to change the curriculum or to get more structure into the curriculum. And of course, there is also a question as to how much good that kind of additional structure would do. So the net effect is that I think we have not done much in the way of curricular change, and I think that continues to be true as far as I know today.
Now, we talked a little bit last time, I believe, about continuing legal education. What shape was that in when you entered as a deanship and as a dean, and how did that evolve?
We had a relationship with the extension, with extension law. There was an extension law department. I don't recall exactly when it started, but I think back perhaps in the 1950s. And again, this is an area where the law school faculty, I think, has some difficulty coming to a conclusion as to just what the relationship of the law school should be to these sorts of outreach programs. I can recall the first faculty meeting I attended back in 1961, fall of 61, where the faculty split right down the middle as to whether we should have an extension law program or not. And Dean George Young cast the deciding vote and decided that we would have an extension law program. And Professor Gus Eckhart, who was put in charge of it at the time, was very active in promoting it. And in my early days on the faculty, I benefited in the sense that I participated in a good number of the programs that were being put on, particularly in connection with the enactment of the Uniform Commercial Code in Wisconsin. In the early days, in the 60s, Professor Eckhart managed to create a structure which combined Marquette University Law School, University of Wisconsin Law School, and the State Bar in a program called Continuing Legal Education for Wisconsin, or CLU for short. That program continued until, I would guess, around 1967 or 68. And at that point, the State Bar decided to drop out and to have its own continuing legal education program. But the Extension Law Department has continued to conduct some programs. And in 1976, Arnon Allen, who was then the director of the Extension Law Department, was appointed as an associate dean for continuing legal education in the law school. The law school picked up part of his salary, and in return, Extension Law agreed to make an equivalent amount of money available to law professors during the summer for some summer support, with the idea that the professors would develop programs which could be useful as extension programs. And a few faculty members did participate. I don't know whether that arrangement is still continuing or not, but sometime after I left the deanship, David Schultz, who currently is director of the Extension Law Department, was made a full professor in the law school. And so the ties became a little bit closer in that sense. And a number of programs are still being conducted. I think not as extensively as at one time, because the state bar has become the main provider of continuing legal education for lawyers in Wisconsin. I think they are running a very fine program, and there isn't as much need for the university to get into the area as was true at one time. But Extension Law still does some programming, as I say.
You mentioned, we're going to move now to the area of the faculty and the law school. Just from what you've been saying in this session alone, in terms of the extension vote was split down the middle, the research versus clinical, was there's a yin and yang. It sounds like you have a pretty lively faculty, a pretty diverse group of individuals when we're trying to characterize the sort of tenor and tone of the faculty.
I think that's true. I don't mean to suggest that they're always fighting each other.
No, that wasn't.
In fact, they get along quite well, I would say. But there is that difference in outlook. I think that's fairly clear.
During your years as dean, were there any significant additions or losses to the law school faculty?
Well, I would guess nothing unusual. I summarized this matter, I think, in one of my last reports to the alumni, and I believe that on average we lost two faculty members each year, or about 16 in the 8 years of my tenure as acting dean and dean. And I think that's probably about normal. Now, there were, of course, some longtime faculty members who retired during that period. They are included in this number that I just cited. People like Willard Hurst and Sam Merman and John Conway and others. Dean George Young, former Dean George Young, died in 1982, I believe. So there were significant retirements, and some people left. We probably lost more faculty members to Stanford than any other place over the years. But I don't believe there was anything unusual.
We talked earlier, and I believe Dean Thompson was mentioning this too. The faculty salary issue has always been something UW has a little lower salary. Did that contribute at all to departures? Did that have a real impact on the stability, more or less, the functioning of the law school?
I don't believe that it had a major impact, although it is possible that we might have been able to keep some faculty members we lost if our salary structure had been competitive with places like Stanford and UCLA and so on. More often, it seemed to me, we began running into a situation where it was important to have good employment opportunities for spouses, and I think this continues to be a problem naturally today. And some of the larger metropolitan areas often are at an advantage as compared with Madison in that situation. But certainly the salary situation, I would say, was beginning to get worse toward the end of my deanship because of the effect of inflation and the fact that we had not had any major salary increases during that period. Now, the university as a whole, of course, recognized this, I think, around 1984-85, and that's when we had the so-called catch-up increases, which was a major boon to the law school, and Dean Cliff Thompson was able, because we could show that our salary structure was poor compared with competitive schools, was able to, I think, get a little extra money out of that in addition to the general percentage increase that went to most departments in the university. So that I think, has been a tremendous help to the law school.
You mentioned spouses, placement of faculty spouses. That raises an interesting issue that I hadn't thought about. When did the, or has it always been, when did the issue of finding jobs for spouses start to really be something that was fairly commonly talked about?
I am not sure exactly when it started, but I would say certainly by around 1980 and maybe before that, it was a fairly significant issue.
Let's talk about research for just one moment. What do you perceive as the strengths and weaknesses in the area of research at UW during your tenure as dean?
I think that in view of the resources that were available to the law school, we did quite well in the research area. And I have to give a fair amount of credit to David Trubeck, whom I appointed sometime during the latter part of the 70s, I guess, as Associate Dean for Research. He took over some of the functions which previously had been handled by a committee of the faculty, and was given a release time, half time, to promote research. That was one of his main interests, and so it seemed sensible to have him do that. And he, along with some other members of the faculty, managed to get some fairly major research grants, at least insofar as the law school is concerned, because the law school typically has not had very much in the way of research grants. But there was, I suppose, the biggest one was one from the Department of Justice to study litigation costs in federal courts, which was, I think, in the amount of $1,300,000. That came along around 1980. And there were some other smaller ones. So I felt that the law school was doing well insofar as research was concerned. We managed to make some alumni funds available as seed money to help faculty members develop research proposals. We started a program of so-called mini-grants to give faculty members some support during the summer to develop research grants, again, sort of seed money from alumni funds. And one of the major thrusts of the capital fund drive that we began talking about, I think, around 1980 or sooner, but did not really get underway until about 1982, was to raise money for research as well as raise money for law school professorships of the type that provide a little extra money on top of salary to be used for research support or secretarial support or travel.
The chaired or endowed.
I'm not sure how much. I think they provide something like $7,500 per year now for that purpose. And as a result of this fund drive, we have acquired a good many of them. In fact, I think there are something like 15 or 16 professors on the faculty now who have these named professorships, so that that should provide a boost to research, as well as being, in a sense, an enhancement of faculty compensation. Now that really has come about pretty much in the last 7 or 8 years since I left the deanship, because we did not get this major fund drive underway until around 1982.
In some of my interviews with engineering professors, deans, they said that in the field of engineering, research wasn't even an issue at the university until after World War II, that it was essentially a teaching function in the School of Engineering, and that it has significantly increased over time since World War II. Kind of looking at the large scope of it, has research, you've been associated with the law school since World War II in one capacity or another, has research gained more emphasis over time, or has it been fairly level, or
It's my impression too that it has gained more emphasis over time, and I think the divisional committee structure has had something to do with that. Now it's true that I guess those committees have existed for a long time, but I think that there has been considerable increase in emphasis on research over the past 15 years. That would be my impression.
One other question before we leave the faculty, it just occurred to me. I'm thinking of the medical school, which is sort of similar to the law school in that you're both professional schools. How has the issue of extra income, I mean, these people are all lawyers, I'm sure some of them are involved in private practice, et cetera, as well as being in law school. Was that issue a problem at all during, or an issue at all during your tenure as dean?
I think that the issue did come up from time to time, but that it was not a major issue during my deanship. And I think the reason is that law faculty members, for the most part, did not engage in the type of practice for outside income that medical school faculty do, and in fact it has been frowned upon in law school circles. I think it's possible that may be changing a little bit. We have two or three faculty members now who are associated with law firms in Madison, and I believe spend about one day a week at those law firms. But it is an issue that has come up. I did not particularly review the faculty minutes when we talked about it, so I guess I can't comment on it with any specificity, except to say that it has not been really a major issue.
Before we move on to the next major category here, accreditation and evaluation, let me just say for the people listening here that we have mentioned some articles, et cetera, on file. These are available to anybody listening to these. They are in Dean Hellstad's folder. These are his reports as they came out in the law school
alumni magazine
called Gargoyle. Okay, we'll switch the site. This is Barry Tyker, side 2 of tape 3. We're moving on to accreditation and evaluation. We spoke a little bit about this in tapes 1 and 2, but we're going to handle it as a unit here. Could you discuss or put in context the accreditation problems the law school has had over the years with the ABA and the AALS?
Problems have, I think, been primarily a shortage of building space and a shortage of funding, both for the faculty and for library. That's what it is in a nutshell. The American Bar Association and Association of American Law Schools set up standards for the accreditation of law schools. And every so often there is supposed to be an inspection of the school. We had one back in 1971, which was very critical of the law school. There was a re-inspection in 1974, where we were able to show some progress, but not enough to satisfy the accreditation agency. And at that point, they threatened to take further action against the law school unless we made improvements quite rapidly. There were some funding improvements that came along in the sense of addition to the budget in 1975 to enable us to continue our clinical programs. The funding for those had run out, that is, the grants from the Ford Foundation Agency had run out. And then there was an additional supplement to the budget in 1976. There was a re-inspection of the law school in 1978, and the accreditation team again said that the law school was inadequately funded and that we needed more space. The accrediting agency, I think, relaxed or relented somewhat after that 1978 inspection, but never gave the law school a clean bill of health. I understand that as a result of an inspection that took place, I believe, in 1989, that the law school has now been given a clean bill of health because of the substantial improvements in the salary structure as a result of the catch-up races that occurred in the mid-80s. And the money raised through the major fund drive that we had, the capital fund drive, perhaps the one thing that remains is to improve the physical facilities, and certainly Dean Bernstein is working very hard to raise money to help help assure that the building will be improved. Now, that's a very brief summary, and you may want to ask some more detailed questions.
Well, we did cover a lot of the in-between in the past. What kind of a, how did this, we can call it a cloud, I guess, hanging over the law school's head during these years, did this impair the functioning of the law school at all?
How much
of a problem was it?
I don't believe that it really impaired the functioning of the law school to any great extent. As I indicated early in this interview, one of my main missions as dean was to kind of get a light on the school as possible in my reports to the alumni and in my interviews with newspaper people, because I felt that we did have a good law school, and despite the funding difficulties, and that the law school had received too much of a negative image. And that there was some danger that this could result in deterioration if it started to keep students away and kept us from acquiring good faculty members and so on. There was a, for whatever their worth, there was a ranking of law schools, a couple of rankings of law schools that came out around 1977 or 78, which placed the law school about 17th from the top, which sort of indicated to me that negative publicity in the early 70s had not done all that much damage. And I felt, I suppose, somewhat vindicated in my approach in trying to put the law school in the best light I could.
But it's gracious that they twisted your arm that much. I mean, the school's arm, and you were ranked 17th. What must they have been doing to the people who were down in the lower half of the 50s and 60s and 70s of the ranking?
Well, I don't know. As I think I mentioned once before in this interview, one of the tacks they were taking is that if a law school considered itself to be one of the leading law schools in the country, that law school should be held to higher standards. That is, in addition to the education. So that was some of what was going on.
Did you ever call up, just pick up the phone when you had these to-dos with the accreditation agencies, and call up the dean of the law school at, let's say, University of Michigan or Northwestern or Minnesota, and say, you know, this is happening here. What's happening? Is the same thing happening down in up in Ann Arbor? What are you doing?
I think there was a little bit of that. We did have occasional meetings with other deans, and I know Northwestern, considered one of the top law schools in the country, was under some pressure to make improvements, and I think that was true of a number of others.
So sort of a form of tough love here on the part of the accreditation agency. Mm-hmm. Let's move to you mentioned a few minutes ago, the self-study of the law school, which was conducted by the faculty in 1980 and 81. This is something that happens like about every 5 years or so?
It is supposed to happen regularly, and again, this is part of the accreditation requirement.
Okay.
I think it's a pretty good idea in any event, but one of the points made by the 1978 accreditation team was that we had not had a self-study for a number of years. So I think that was one of the things that led to the self-study that we had.
What were the...
Recognition, of course, that our salary structure needed improvement, and there was a good deal of discussion of whether we were properly allocating resources, classroom type of teaching, and the clinical type of teaching. And as I have mentioned, there was a slight cutback in the clinical type of instruction as a result of this study. But on the whole, I think that things were not changed very much as a result of the study.
Another question that just occurred to me, and then we'll leave this area. With the help of hindsight, the accreditation, the changes you had to make based on the accreditation, do you think the accreditation process ended up helping the UW Law School in the long run? Was it a beneficial because it put pressure on you to make changes, or were these changes unwelcome or unneeded?
It's difficult to say, I think, how much it helped. I think in general, though, it is a good idea to have some outside standards, as long as they're not applied too rigidly. There has been some talk about trying to change the standards to get away from some of the more specific aspects relating to counts of library books and that sort of thing. But I don't know that anything along that line has happened so far. I think that, I guess I would not recommend that the accrediting agency be abolished. But I also have to say that they made life difficult for me as long as I was dean, or at least during the first 5 years or so of my deanship.
On that note, I think we'll just pass on to the next topic here. We're going to talk a little bit about alumni involvement in the capital fund drive now. You note in Gargoyle that in the summer of 1978, Ed Reisner, is that pronounced correctly?
Yes.
Ed Reisner was hired as an assistant dean for placement and alumni affairs.
He was actually hired in 1975, so that's...
How had alumni affairs been handled before Dean Reisner's appointment, and how did his appointment subsequently?
I think that alumni affairs had been handled primarily through the dean's office, perhaps with some assistance from an assistant dean. We've had a number of people serving in an assistant dean capacity over the years. So I can't say that Ed Reisner was the first. He was the first to be, well, that's not quite true either. William Lewis was the first to be paid out of alumni funds, or to be paid in part out of alumni funds. And that was a change that came about during George Bunn's deanship. And there was some resistance to that idea, the theory being that we didn't want to sully ourselves by hiring a professional fundraiser, which seems like a little quaint right now, but anyway, that was the attitude at the time. But they did agree, finally, that they would help pay for a person on a part-time basis to devote a fair amount of time to alumni affairs. So William Lewis, I think, was hired about 1974 and served in that position for a year or so.
So he wasn't an assistant dean or anything, he was essentially a fundraiser?
I do not recall whether he was given, I believe he was hired just as sort of the alumni relations director. I don't recall what his title was. In any event, Ed Reisner was hired on a full-time basis in 1975 to replace William Lewis and also to replace Mary Staley, who had been serving as placement director. So those two jobs were combined, alumni relations and placement. And that's the way things continued until we got into and at that point it became clear that we needed a major organizational effort. And so the Alumni Association was persuaded that we needed help from the University of Wisconsin Foundation. And they were very willing to help with the fund drive. And David Utley was hired by the foundation to serve as the law school's staff person in organizing this major fund drive. After the fund drive was completed a few years later, the law school decided that it needed to continue this major fundraising effort. And so I knew this would happen. His name slips my mind. Name I know well. But anyway, he was hired to replace Dave Utley and to serve the law school on a full-time basis as a fundraiser. So there have been major changes in the fundraising structure as far as alumni fundraising is concerned as a result of the capital fund drive that was started back in 1982. Chris Richards is the person that I was trying to think of.
Now you mentioned David Utley. He was hired specifically by the foundation to work with the law school on this particular
yes.
drive. He wasn't a member of the foundation who was assigned to this, or
no? He was he was hired by the foundation to be on the foundation staff, but to work for the law school. But the law but the foundation felt that they did not have anyone available on their staff at the time to undertake this major effort with the law school. So Dave Utley was hired to serve in this position. We had a job search and there were a number of people who applied, and David Utley was hired.
Anything particular about his background that you can recall that would have that helped him in this?
Well, I should remember what his background is, but I am not positive that I can state now. He had been working in New York with, I think, some agency of the Ford Foundation, and is one of the interesting incidents is that he is the son of Clifton Utley, who was a major radio news commentator back in the 1940s and 1950s. And I used to listen to Clifton Utley on the radio when I was a student at La Crosse State Teachers College back in the early 40s. So it was, I thought it was sort of interesting that his son and I became good friends, and that he helped us with this important fund drive.
Had the law school ever used used the UW Foundation before this?
Not to any extent, and this is, I think, a change in that came about as a result of this fund drive. The Board of Directors of the Alumni Association were somewhat reluctant at first because they felt they would be giving up control and so on, but they were eventually persuaded that if we were going to raise large sums of money, we needed the organizational structure which the foundation could provide.
And when we're talking about large sums of money, what are we talking, what was your the fund?
We started out with, I think, initially a goal of $1 million, but it became clear that the organizational effort that we had to go through was so massive that we might as well go for a larger sum. So that was increased to $3 million, and then $4 million as a goal. And I think eventually we raised about $7 million. Mm. Now, I left the deanship about a year or so after the fund drive was underway, so that Cliff Thompson took over and carried it through, and deserves some of the credit for the success of that fund drive. But it turned out to be a very successful fund drive, and I think it was a major turning point in the well-being of the law school.
Generally speaking, how much of that $7 million was raised from alumni? Did a lot of it come through foundations or grants?
I think most of it came from alumni. Some of it came from law firms, where we have a good number of alumni members. Part of it was kind of fortuitous. We got a couple of big bequests around 1982, around the time of the start of the fund drive, which we counted as part of the total. We would have gotten those anyway, but one of them was a bequest of $1,300,000 to be used for student scholarships, student financial support. Yeah. Another was a bequest of around $150,000 to be used for library support. So we had that good fortune, but I think the rest of it came pretty much from alumni, and from some law firms where our alumni were the dominant members.
How did you and the foundation, meaning the law school and the foundation, did you have a pretty good working relationship throughout the course of the fund drive?
I think so. I'm not aware of any problems.
Okay. Cliff, by the way, for people listening, I did interview Cliff Thompson, and Cliff talks about the fund drive, too, so you can check that for additional information. We're going now to June 29th, 1982, to your resignation. You announced that you were stepping down from dean, as dean, to return to teaching and research. Let me begin by asking you what factors led to this decision to resign the deanship.
In part, I just felt tired, I guess, and that I didn't have the kind of energy to continue for another several years, and that the law school needed some fresh perspectives. In part, it is also true that a number of the faculty felt that there should be a change in the deanship, perhaps as many as half of the faculty thought that we had come to a point where we probably ought to have more aggressive leadership in the law school than they thought I was providing. And that may very well be true. In any event, I was 60 years old at the time, and I had made plans that I would work until I was at least 65, and I did not think that under any circumstances I wanted to continue in the job for another 5 years. So it was partly a personal decision and partly the fact that the law school, I think, was at a point where it was good for the law school to have different leadership.
In terms of that different leadership, were you involved at all in the input for the search for the new dean? Or?
No. I made myself available to talk with candidates, but apart from that, I did not have any involvement.
Any comments or observations on Cliff Thompson, your successor?
Well, my perception is that Cliff Thompson did an excellent job. I think he was the right person at the right time. In some ways, I think I was the right person at the right time back in 1975, but times change, and I think Cliff, who had had a lot of experience in administration, was an ideal person for the law school at the time. At least that's the way it turned out, I believe. I think he did a fine job.
Any comments or observations on his successor and the current law school dean, Dan Bernstein?
No, I've been pretty much fully retired since Dan Bernstein took over. I've known Dan for a long time, and I think he's a fine person. And I understand that he is spending about 50% of his time on alumni relations and fundraising, which perhaps is an indication of the changing nature of the deanship at the law school. And I guess I'm glad that I am not in that position anymore, because I think my strengths were more in internal administration than in going out and talking with alumni on a regular basis, although I did not mind doing that, but I think that other people can do it better. So as far as I know, things are going well.
Now, you retired from the deanship, but you didn't really retire from the university. You retired back to the classroom, more or less. You remained at the university for another 5 years then? When was your retirement?
I technically retired in 1985. So that I could draw a pension, but continued to teach on a part-time basis after that. That's possible with the permission of the faculty, as long as you don't earn too much. So I did a couple of things after I left the deanship. I continued to run for a while a course that I had been teaching since about 1981 with Robert Arthur, an alumnus who offered to put up a sum of money that the students could use as sort of an investment course. That's basically what it was. He felt very strongly that lawyers who were going to have business clients particularly needed to know something about this area, and offered to give the law school a substantial sum of money to be used in this sort of a program, so that I organized this course along with Robert Arthur and ran it, I guess, for 5 years or so. And then the money that had been used for investing was to be turned over to the University of Wisconsin Foundation to provide funding for one of these professorships, a professorship in Arthur's name. And that has happened. I think we taught that course, I believe, until around 1985 or 86, and then dropped it. And the money was turned over to the foundation. Since that time, the course, incidentally, was given for so-called non-law credit. That is, students are permitted to take up to 6 credits of their 90 required for graduation outside of law school. As long as they're sort of law related, and the credits that were given for this course were among the 6 non-law credits that a student could pick up. So that's the way that part was handled, and I was basically in charge of the academic part of the course, Arthur assisted as a lecturer in the course. Another thing that I did was to serve as director of our general practice course from 1983, when I left the deanship, until I retired completely, which I guess was in the spring of 1990.
We've covered a lot of territory here.
Yeah.
I'm pretty much out of questions and very pleased with the responses. Are there any additional comments or reflections that you would like to make, either on your deanship or on your career here at Medetti?
No, I don't think so. I realize that my remarks have been somewhat rambling, but I hope that they may be of some use. I guess I feel fortunate to have been a member of the University of Wisconsin Law School faculty for all these years. I've always felt very grateful for the education I got here, and so it has been a good career as far as I'm concerned, but at this point I'm also glad that I'm retired.
Well, I will violently disagree with you on the fact that you think these remarks are a little bit rambling. I think you're absolutely wrong on that one, Kyle. We'll end the interview here March 30th, 1999 with former law school dean, Warren Halstead. Thank you.